Dr. Roger Walsh, and I would like to introduce him too. So Dr. Roger Walsh, MD, PhD, DHL, holds doctorates in medicine, neuroscience, humanities, and is a professor of psychiatry, philosophy, and anthropology at the University of California. He researches virtues such as love and wisdom, practices to cultivate them, such as meditation and integral responses to our contemporary global crisis. He is also author of several books, including The World of Shamanism, Essential Spirituality, The Seven Central Practices, and his work has received over 20 national and international awards. Together with other IEC presenters, John Dupuy, Douglas Prater, and Heidi Mitchell, he is also starting a podcast titled Deep Transformation, Self, Society, Spirit, to help bring more integral people and ideas to the web. He was also formerly a circus acrobat and a world record high diver. Recently, he graduated from the San Francisco Comedy College, and he had an extremely brief and unsuccessful career as a stand-up comedian. He has spent the last 3 months in a silent meditation retreat with Dan Brown as his teacher, and just re-entered the world and began talking again on Monday. You can learn more of Roger Walsh at his website, www.drrogerwalsh.com. And what is not written in his website, but many know in the integral community, that Roger Walsh is also an outstanding figure, an early father of the transpersonal psychology movement. And he was the one, or one of those, who discovered and mentored Ken Wilber in the 80s into the transpersonal movement. And also he and his wife, who unfortunately is not with us anymore, passed away, I think 2 years ago, Francis Vohen, was also an outstanding figure in transpersonal psychology and psychotherapy. And Francis and Roger introduced Treya to Ken at their house in the 80s, which was also mentioned yesterday in the movie trailer and can be seen in the upcoming movie Grace and Greed soon. So Roger is not only a terrific theorist and expert in the areas that we mentioned, but also an outstanding figure in both the transpersonal integral movement and also a natural link between the two movements, a true elder of our community and a long-term dear friend of Ken Wilber. So welcome, Roger. Please make your keynote.
Moment to thank all the... I'm told I'm now being unmuted, that I wasn't muted. So let me just say thank you, Bensa. And let me also say thank you so much to the integral team, that the fact that you've managed to, getting a sign saying I was not unmuted. So anyway, I don't know how much you heard, but anyway, I'll just go on. So okay. Thank you very much to all the integral team. The fact you managed to pull this off in 6 weeks is just astounding. And what a gift that we have 1,000 people from around the world feasting on this just sheer delight or cornucopia of ideas and wonderful people. So thank you very, very much. As so many speakers have mentioned, we're really in a time of civilizational crisis. And of course, it's COVID which gets the attention, but so many speakers have eloquently mentioned the fact that we are facing a multitude of crises. Terry Patton called it the meta crisis. And there's a really curious paradox here, because this is a tragedy, and in many ways it's what we in the integral community have been preparing ourselves for. For we have been training ourselves to understand the world and its challenges as fully and deeply as we possibly can, with as much sensitivity, with integrally, and we've been trying to cultivate the qualities of heart and mind that are so desperately needed at this time. And so this equips us to contribute in ways we've been wanting to. And what would we want more than to help and heal at this time when healing is so desperately needed? So what I'd like to explore today is how we can contribute as effectively as possible, particularly using our unique integral perspective. And to do that, we need to understand several things. And the first of them is motivation. Now, most of us are very familiar with Maslow's hierarchy of needs, and I'm going to share my screen here. This wasn't so successful before, but let's hope it is now. And oops, it just disappeared.
We can see it very well. You might want to switch to full screen, Roger.
Okay, well, if I can,
yes,
just
we see
switch
it.
Me. Okay, you see it, I don't.
Yes.
Oh. Okay, well, let's see. So I can't see it to control it. So there we have a problem here. Let's see if I can. Let's see. Okay, let me try again. And okay. Maud, if I don't succeed, I may ask you to do these for me. Okay. I'm not having luck with this.
Yes.
Okay.
Seeing it's nice.
Success. All perfect. Right. Wonderful. So you know this model well. This is Maslow's hierarchy of needs. We were all kind of raised on this with the idea that there are basic needs, psychological needs, and Maslow's contribution was to add at the top self-actualization. And he drew a distinction between the ordinary needs all the way up to esteem as being deficiency-based needs. And his contribution, one of his many contributions, was to point out that there are also sufficiency needs, which he particularly identified as self-actualization. And once you get a feel for the distinction between the deficiency and sufficiency needs, it becomes a very powerful and life-changing recognition. And you can just feel, for example, the difference between a relationship in which you're with someone who's coming at you with out of deficiency, wanting, needing, as opposed to when both people are able to come out of a sense of sufficiency and well-being, and then there's no need to try and get anything from the other person, but rather there's a joyful sharing and a mutual enhancement. So that was a very important contribution. But in his later life, Maslow pointed out that beyond self-actualization was self-transcendence, and that self-transcendence was the need he recognized for all of us to recognize and grow into a larger identity, a transpersonal identity. And as integral practitioners, we've probably all been working to actualize our capacities, that is to self-actualize and to self-transcend, to touch into and gradually identify more and more with our transpersonal identity. Now, one thing that's important to know about these motivational needs is that they're not hard stages as in cognitive development, where you don't go back so much, but these are more soft or fluid stages which we can shift across depending on our circumstances and state of mind. And at our best, predominant motives are the higher motives of self-actualization and self-transcendence. Okay, so most of you probably know this, but I want to suggest something radical. I want to suggest that now, 50 years after Maslow offered us this very important map of motivation, we are ready to expand and update it and to add a further stage. And so I want to suggest that there is a stage beyond self-transcendence. And when I was in my Zen training phase, I remember my Zen teacher asked once what I was working on. I said, well, I'm doing an article on the art of self-transcendence. And without an instant's hesitation, she came back and said, well, of course, eventually you'll have to transcend transcendence. And that's exactly what the great contemplative traditions say, is that, yes, we work, we practice, we meditate, we cultivate for self-transcendence, but eventually we have to go beyond that, because as all the contemplative traditions point out, we don't practice for ourselves alone, we practice for everyone. And so across traditions, you find that the idea that self-transcendence ultimately is in the service of selfless service, and that the more we experience self-transcendence, the more we recognize our broader, larger, higher identity, the more we recognize it in everyone, and the more we recognize our interconnection and unity with them. And then service becomes an automatic response. Of course, we want to help ourself. And so selfless service then becomes a powerful motive that for some people becomes a central motive of their life. So in conclusion, I think we can now say that beyond self-transcendence is selfless service. Okay, well, that's an interesting advance. Well, is there anything beyond selfless service? And in point of fact, the world's contemplative traditions point out that at a certain stage, all seeking, even the very highest and most altruistic and service-oriented, has to be released. And that we have to go beyond all motivation and come to a place of motivation transcendence, where we rest in being or awareness. Because eventually we recognize that what we ultimately seek is always already here now. And as long as we're seeking, we're imagining that we have to achieve something in the future rather than recognize something in the present. And also we recognize that as long as we're doing, as long as there's active intention, it feeds and supports and maintains the separate self sense. And there's also a recognition that you just can't force your way into the absolute. You can't manipulate God. And that was actually one of the most profound recognitions of these last 3 months of retreat. And I'd known this idea of motivation transcendence, but it came really clear at a certain stage in this meditation retreat. I could see that in very subtle ways, I was trying to make something happen. I was trying to force my way into the recognition of and the stance of identifying as pure, infinite awareness. And no, it doesn't work. It's always already present. And we have to allow ourselves to relax and release. And then we find it's already here and we're already it. So yes, we can prepare ourselves, especially by purification or cleaning up, but we can't force it at the end. And there's a saying that enlightenment is an accident, but meditation makes you accident prone. This is widely recognized across traditions. The great sage Aurobindo, who Ken describes as the greatest philosopher sage of all time, says, if you want to be a true doer of divine works, your first aim must be to be totally free from all desires. And the Taoist sage Chuang Tzu put it this way, no drives, no compulsions, no needs, no attractions. Then your affairs are under control. You are free. So there's a wonderful paradox. because it's true that we need to clean up and grow up and wake up, but eventually we also need to give up. We need to give up even the most transcendent and altruistic of motives and trust in the moment, trust in who our true nature. And as the third Zen patriarch says, the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. So I think we can add two new motives here, selfless service and motivation transcendence, a kind of motivational singularity where all motives drop away. But even that isn't the end, because at a certain stage, spontaneous, egoless activity and service occurs. And here, we find that as we relinquish any egoic striving, we find ourselves falling into our true nature, our true identity, our identity in oneness with the All or the Tao or the Infinite or God, and that works and moves through us. And so now we find ourselves acting and serving, but with an egoless spontaneity. And this is described across multiple traditions. Both Dzogchen and Vedanta describe it as spontaneity. In advanced Vipassana meditation, it's effortless effort. In Taoism, it's Wu Wei, meaning action without intention. In Neo-Confucianism, it's the state of mental equilibrium, where the mind is at perfect equilibrium and spontaneously responds to whatever situation it faced. And I could give more examples, but maybe I'll just conclude with a quote by the great religious scholar Kumaraswamy, who described this as a perpetual, uncalculated life in the present. So at this stage, service returns again, but now it's truly selfless service, because the separate self-sense or ego has been transcended. So we need to not only grow up and wake up and give up, we need to open up to the infinite, to the Tao, to God. So it seems we have multiple higher motives. And this is terribly important to recognize, because Maslow pointed out that motives need to be satisfied. And if we don't recognize and honor and fulfill our higher motives, or meta motives as he called them, we suffer. And he described this kind of suffering where we don't recognize and live into our higher motives as metapathologies. And they're subtle, but they're very painful. Their sense of meaninglessness or apathy or nihilism. And the problem is that because our culture doesn't recognize these meta motives, and particularly these new higher motives I've mentioned, that people don't understand why they're suffering in these ways. And we see so much of this in the culture, people, nihilism and apathy and meaninglessness, with people not understanding the true cause. So we not only want to serve, we need to serve. This is built into us. And that's why serving as integral practitioners at this time is not only appropriate for us because of our integral orientation, It's appropriate because we recognize that we need to need to. So once we recognize these higher motives and see that this is really important to us, then the crucial question becomes, how can I serve? How can I serve most effectively? And there are three crucial questions here. You know, when there's a crisis of some kind, most of the conventional response is for people to say is, well, they should do this, or the politicians should do that, or the people in power should, etc. But it only takes a moment's reflection to realize that if there's to be any real change that we want to see, then we have to initiate, we have to contribute. So the question automatically arises, what can I do? But there's a deeper question beyond that. And that is, what's the most strategic thing I can do? And that's a question for us to sit and wrestle with. But even that isn't the highest question. Because the highest question is, how can I transform my life so that I become an ongoing instrument of service? How can I become an optimal instrument of service? Now, to answer these questions well, we need to know that there are two very different kinds of questions. There are knowledge questions and there are wisdom questions, and they're very different. Knowledge questions have a one-time answer. Is it raining outside? Open the window, no rain, end of question. But wisdom questions are more like koans. And every time you ask a wisdom question, such as what's the most strategic contribution I can make, or how can I become an optimal instrument of service? Every time you ask those questions, they take you deeper into the question, deeper into yourself, and deeper into reality. So these are questions which we will probably be asking ourselves for the rest of our lives. So to fulfill our role as contributors, as integral practitioners, we want to know about motivation. We want to ask these wisdom questions, finding out how we can serve most effectively. And then there are some other things we need to know in order to serve effectively. And the first thing we need to know at this particular time of a time of crisis is, how do people respond to threat? And under crisis and severe threat, most people, not all people by any means, tend to regress psychologically to less mature developmental stages and responses. They tend to become defensive, understandably, more egocentric, more short-term vision, and have tunnel vision. Again, not everyone. Some people rise spontaneously to the occasion, particularly people who've prepared themselves. However, the automatic response to severe threat is to regress. Now, people can respond more maturely and effectively and skillfully or benevolently if we provide them with three things. If we provide them with a context that makes sense of the crisis, a purpose with which they can be motivated, and a means or ways in which they can respond skillfully. So looking at those first, a skillful context. Providing a skillful context for the COVID crisis might be something like, yes, this is a dangerous situation and we did not prepare well for it. However, we can respond well and wisely, and we can become a better and wiser culture, and all of us can learn and grow in the process. This is what psychologists call reframing. It involves people giving a new perspective, which offers new possibilities, new ways of looking at things. And really importantly, reframing is the fastest therapeutic intervention I know of. Stabilizing states of consciousness takes months. Stabilizing stages of development takes years. But you can reframe in a second. If you can just feel where a person's coming from, where they're stuck, what's creating their pain and their stuckness, and just provide an alternate perspective and reframe it, the situation for them, in that moment, you can offer them a way to a vision of possibility and inspiration. So we can reframe. We may want to offer a skillful purpose, such as, okay, well, all of us are needed right now, and all of us can make a contribution, and we can learn and grow in the process. And we may want to offer a means, such as, well, here's a number of things that would be really helpful and that are needed right now. So in that way, at a time of crisis, we provide the three things which allow people to get unstuck, unfrozen, and inspired to contribute and do something skillful. Providing a context, providing a motive, and suggesting some means. Okay. Now, I want to suggest that one context we'll definitely want to offer at this time is that we'll want to leverage the COVID crisis to help people become aware of, or recognize, acknowledge, and respond more skillfully to the other crises that are barreling towards us. So, for example, as a context, we might want to acknowledge to people, we didn't handle this crisis so well. People have been telling us for years that there was another pandemic coming, but we were totally unprepared. I'm at the University of California Medical School and Hospital, one of the biggest and best universities and hospital systems in the world. And we are putting out an appeal to our neighbors to give us masks, because we don't have enough masks for our medical personnel. This is crazy, but that's the way things are. We were inadequately prepared, but this gives us a leverage point. We can point out that we've got other crises coming towards us, ecological crises, climate crises, weapons, pollution, etc. Okay, we know this. How can we respond more skillfully to these than we did to the COVID crisis? How can we learn from our mistakes, and what can we do better? Okay. So those are some of the things that help us to respond more and help people respond more to crisis and trauma. So what's another thing we need to know? We also need to know that the state of the world now reflects the state of our minds. Our technologies are so incredibly powerful that what we see as our global problems are actually global symptoms. They're symptoms of our individual and collective immaturities and pathologies writ large upon the planet, because our technology is so powerful that our psychological and spiritual dysfunctions are manifested and expressed in society and in the civilization and on the planet itself. And what this means, if our global problems are actually global symptoms, is that if we're to heal our global problems, if we're to navigate our way through this civilizational crisis and the crises that are coming at us, we're not going to have to just find a vaccine for COVID and reduce nuclear weapons and stop ecological degradation. We're going to have to deal with the inner psychological and spiritual causes which underlie them. We're going to have to deal with the cultural and social dysfunctions which create them. In short, we need integral responses. And There's a beautiful quote from Aldous Huxley. Huxley wrote the book Island, which was about this utopian society, which was hidden away, and the stranger stumbled into it and was astounded to find this society functioning in a utopian way. And he asked, "Where do you begin?" And they responded, "We begin everywhere at once." And that's what integral allows us to do. So we recognize that the state of the world now reflects the state of our minds, and that we need to address not only the outer or right-hand quadrant issues, but also the inner or left-hand quadrant issues. Okay, next thing we need to know is our usual states of mind are deluded. Okay, that's not good news. The state of the world reflects our minds, but the state, our usual state, is diluted. And you can get a powerful story of this from the life of the Buddha. Remember, the Buddha set out on his quest when he left his secluded, nice, safe palace and saw a sick person, an old, aged person, and a dead corpse. And he was so shocked by the recognition of the inevitability of suffering in human life that he totally changed his life. And the state of mind he experienced is described traditionally as samvega. It's a Pali term that's a little hard to translate because it carries three distinct meanings. The first is a kind of shock and horror at really getting the futility and meaninglessness of unconscious conventional life. The second is a humbling recognition of our own complacency and complicity in living, having lived so blindly and unconsciously ourselves. And the third part of samvega is an electrifying urgency to wake up. And when that recognition of the unconsciousness and the suffering it created is extends to the recognition that that's where other people are too, and that this is a fundamental cause of suffering, then it automatically elicits compassion and the desire to awaken and grow and heal as fully as possible in order to help others awaken and grow and heal as fully as possible. This is in Buddhism the bodhisattva aspiration. The bodhisattva is a person who dedicates their life to awakening and growing and maturing as fully as possible in order to best serve and help and heal and awaken others. And it may be the highest ideal that the human mind has ever created. And thanks to Ken and integral theory, we can now update the bodhisattva aspiration, because we can recognize that in addition to waking up, we also need to grow up as fully as possible. So our mission, not a humble one, is to become integral bodhisattvas. And that's our mission. And it's good to know that our life occupations can be of four levels. We can have a job, we can have a career, we can have a calling, or we can have a mission. And a mission, as I would describe it, is a passionate calling with a transpersonal goal. So, to summarize to date, we see that we need to live fully and happily, we need to serve and contribute. And in order to serve and contribute as fully as possible, we need to know how people respond to stress, that the state of the world reflects the state of our minds, that our usual mind state is deluded, and that the fullest way possible that humans have ever discovered to contribute is to become bodhisattvas, and right now, integral bodhisattvas. So there's one other thing we need to know, and that is optimal contributions will heal both the world and ourselves simultaneously. And we need a practice in which we can learn and heal and grow and awaken while we contribute. And fortunately, there is such a practice. It's the millennia-old practice out of Hinduism called Karma Yoga. And Karma Yoga is the yoga of work and action in the world, in which we use our work and service in the world as our spiritual practice. So it integrates and brings us into alignment both service and our own awakening. And Karma Yoga has four central elements. To do effective Karma Yoga, before you begin any major service, you offer it to a transpersonal source. Traditionally, it was God. It can be any ideal. You do your service as impeccably as you possibly can. Third thing, you learn as much as you possibly can while you're doing it. And fourth, and this is the kind of twister that makes Karma Yoga such a knife edge practice. You do your practice as fully as and effectively as possible while simultaneously letting go attachment to the outcome. So Karma Yoga allows us to be students of everything and every situation we meet. So let's see. I think what I'd like to do, since I see I have a little over 10 minutes left, is I'd like to move into offering a meditation. And I'd like to invite you then to just take a moment to relax and to release. So let's just take a few slow, deep breaths. Ah, yes, the breath. I remember that. So breathe in and let go. Breathe in and let go. Breathe in. And just let go. And take a moment to appreciate and feel gratitude for all the gifts we've received over the last few days in this conference. All the ideas and inspirations and transmissions. And just let gratitude fill your heart. And now it's time to take the gifts we've received and the gifts we have and the gifts we are out into the world to help, to heal this enormous ocean of pain and suffering. And what I'd like to invite you to do is to imagine yourself a few years from now as you'd most like to be. I'd like to invite you to see yourself having done the things you want to do, having made the contributions you want to make, having become the kind of person you want to be. So you're seeing yourself as your ideal person, the person you, this is who you will become. And look around your environment. What kind of situation have you created for yourself? Who are you with? And in this environment, what are you doing? What are you creating? And what contributions are you making? And how do you feel? Be aware of your experience. How do you feel contributing and being this person you've made yourself into? What is your body posture like? What strengths are you experiencing? How have you grown? And what is most rewarding and satisfying to you? In order to create this ideal future self, what strengths and capacities would you have to recognize in yourself? In order to create this future ideal self, what strengths and capacities would you have to recognize in yourself? And what strengths and capacities would you have to recognize in others? And in order to become this ideal self, in what way would you have to stop underestimating yourself? And in order to become this ideal self, what would you have to stop pretending that you don't know? And what would you have to stop pretending that you can't do? What would you have to stop pretending you can't do? And is there something you could do right now to begin moving towards becoming this ideal self? Is there some commitment, some acknowledgement? Is there anything you could do right now to begin the process of becoming this ideal self? And if it feels right, do it. Wonderful. Beautiful. And bring your awareness back to this moment and back to our community. So in conclusion, what we most deeply want is to be integral bodhisattvas. And to do this, we orient our lives around the five highest motives. And whatever extent we can, we offer ourselves to the highest good so that our body minds may become instruments of service. We relieve suffering and suffering and its causes in each quadrant. We help people heal and grow and awaken. And we do all this as karma yoga. We go deeper into ourselves to go more effectively out into the world. And we go out into the world in order to go deeper into ourselves. And we continue this cycle of learning and growing and awakening and serving until they become spontaneous expressions of our true nature. And then the universe learns, grows, awakens, and serves itself through us. Our world is in deep, deep trouble, but our world also rests in good hands, because ultimately it rests in yours. I thank you deeply for all the contributions you've made and all the contributions you will make. Thank you so much.